Okay, so what I want to talk about is a series of four papers. First, my convention for the metric is 1 ⁻⁻⁰, the opposite of the relativity's metric. And the reason, I'll show it a little in another view graph. Okay, the papers that I'm going to talk about, let's see, are this one, which I'll talk about briefly as the motivation for my dark energy action, a paper with Fethi Ramazanoglu applying it to the Schwarzschild-like solutions, then a gravity essay which describes these two, and then finally a paper where I look at perturbations on Robertson-Walker. How is that going to go? Whoops. Come on, it's not working. Or is it the other way? No, it's not working. All right.
Call them.
Is there a page down on the machine? I can just use that. Okay. So let me just summarize what I'm going to talk about. The usual cosmological constant action is minus lambda over 8 pi g, the integral of the invariant volume, d4x times the square root of the metric to the 1/2. I'll just, in talking, say this is the invariant 4-volume element. I'm going to talk about the implications of a different action, S effective, which is the 4-volume element divided by G naught naught squared. For a Robertson-Walker metric, where dS squared is dT squared minus a scale factor A squared of T times dx squared, G naught naught is 1, so 1 and 2 are indistinguishable. But their symmetry properties are different. 1 is 4-space general coordinate invariant. 2 is 3-space general coordinate invariant, so it has a smaller diffeomorphism invariance, but it's invariant under Weyl scaling, g mu nu goes to lambda squared g mu nu, because this square root of 4g is like 2 powers in the metric, and this is 2 powers in the metric downstairs. Now, first question, is frame dependence allowed? Before the cosmological background radiation was discovered, the answer would have been no. The dictum was the laws of physics cannot depend on the state of uniform motion. After CMB, the answer is yes. The dipole of the CMB gives our velocity relative to the CMB rest frame. We're moving at a velocity of about 369 kilometers per second relative to that particular frame. And so there is a meaning to state of uniform motion, and in principle, other physics could be tied to the CMB rest frame.
Excuse me, but we had evidence of the existence of matter even before.
Mach's principle and all that was the same idea, but the CMB makes it very graphic, 369 kilometers per second in the direction was the Andromeda Nebula or something like that. That's just pretty remarkable.
But the statement really is true, only the CMB is like exactly homogeneous, not exactly homogeneous.
No, I know. It's almost exactly homogeneous. Okay, so motivations. I started working on this because of my interest in something called trace dynamics, which I won't describe in a lot of detail. The idea was to start with the dynamics of matrix-valued variables that are non-commuting. The Qs and Ps don't commute. The Qs don't commute with each other. The Ps don't commute with the other Ps. There are no built-in Heisenberg commutation relations. And I have a book, a Cambridge University Press book about this, but I decided to look at what happens when I put it in a classical g mu nu background as opposed to putting it in flat space time, which is what was in the book. The idea of trace dynamics is the canonical ensemble average of things gives an effect of emergent quantum theory. So you're averaging over an ensemble is the inverse of partition function, e to the minus some dimensional factor times the trace Hamiltonian, where the trace Hamiltonian is the integral of the 4-3, now it's integral d3x, 4g to the 1/2 times a trace of t sub 0 super 0. This is the trace Hamiltonian. And I'm going to define an induced gravitational action as the integral over the 4-volume element of the trace of the average over this ensemble of the Lagrangian over a normalizing factor of trace 1. So here, the average is the integral over phase space of these matrix variables of rho times the Lagrangian. Now, the trace H uses integral d3x, so it picks a frame and therefore it's three-space general coordinate invariant, but not four-space general coordinate invariant. But there's also an additional symmetry here. Let's define while scaling as g mu nu goes to lambda squared g mu nu. And for matter fields, the q's go to a certain weight factor times a q, and the p's to another weight times a p's. I won't list these. There's a very nice paper of Forger and Roemer in Annals of Physics who show that 4g to the 1/2 times L is while invariant for massless spin 0, 1/2, and 1 matter fields. And in the paper that in which I started looking at this, I show that 4g to the 1/2 t sub mu super nu is also while invariant for massless matter fields, where lambda here is a constant global while. So these together imply that the induced gravitational action is while scaling invariant. And as we saw, it's three-space general coordinate invariant. Now, the zeroth order in metric derivatives, if you put in no metric derivatives, that means that delta SG has to have the form integral over the invariant volume element times g naught naught to the minus 2. That's to make this part scale invariant. And then a function of things that is scale invariant that's constructed from g naught I and things of that sort. So for diagonal metrics, it simplifies to delta SG is integral to d4g, 4g to the 1/2, g naught naught to the minus 2 times just a constant when g naught I and g naught j are 0. And that starts looking like a cosmological action. I mean, I first derived this and said, now what is this going to do to Robertson-Walker? And then I found it does nothing, that it just mimics a cosmological constant. And that's when I sort of perked my ears up and said, this is beginning to look a bit interesting. Now, another motivation that actually figured in what I'm doing is that Hooft wrote a gravitational essay, Local Conformal Symmetry, the missing symmetry component for space and time. And seeing that, I thought, well, I should write up my first two papers as a gravitational essay. And then that motivated me to go back and look at a question that a bunch of people had asked me, what does this action do to gravitational waves? And that's the motivation for the second part of the talk. All right, but first, okay, now I have to address a general question. How do you get the equations of motion? If you vary delta SG with respect to the full G mu nu, you get a delta T induced that does not obey covariant conservation, because the derivation of a covariant conservation requires four-space general coordinate invariance of the Lagrangian. So you have to proceed as follows, and this is where there start to be connections with ADM and with space dynamics. Shape dynamics, yes. So I vary with respect to G sub ij, just the spatial components, which are, of course, are the fundamental degrees of freedom of the dynamical field when you think of it as evolving in time, of a Hamiltonian approach. So you get gij plus 8 pi g times the delta t ij. I'll later on drop the g. The g is the induced gravitational part, and then there's the matter part. And then what you do is take the covariant conservation equation, which is dictated by the Bianchi identities, if I want to get a four-space generalization of this, and just infer delta ti0 and delta t00 to satisfy this equation. And this gives a consistent four-space version, g mu nu plus delta t g mu nu plus delta plus t mu nu matter equals 0 as my field equations. So I'm doing a Bianchi or a covariant conserving completion of my three-space equation.
Steve, does infirming you as functions in the matter fields, you invent what it has to be?
Does what?
Does it mean that you invent functions in the matter fields to be what they have to be so that you get covariant conservation? What do you mean by
it? No, it's just a function of the metric. I'll show that in a minute.
Okay.
Because the only thing I'm adding, the delta TG, is just a function of just a metric.
Just a metric.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a trace anomaly.
It's a bit like a trace anomaly. And I'll show exactly how you do it in the examples I give. Okay, so now let me get the first application, which is spherically symmetric Schwarz-Hadamard solutions. This was done with Fethi Ramazanoglu. He was a pre-thesis student from Princeton with me, and then he did a numerical relativity thesis with Franz Pretorius. And then when I had this problem to work on, it was natural to collaborate with him. He taught me a lot about using Mathematica to solve general relativity equations. Okay, so we did both a rather extended analytic and numerical treatment of this problem. First, in polar coordinates, now I'll take the little g off. So delta t is the induced gravitational part. later my little g will be gauge changes, so I'm going to drop the little g here. So in polar coordinates, ds squared is b of r dt squared minus a of r dr squared minus r squared times the angular line element. And if I now vary the spatial components, I get delta t ij is lambda over 8 pi g gij over b squared. Delta t sub ij, just the power of b squared comes downstairs from that, from okay, this, that, I have to check that, but that should be an A there. Anyway, varying G, you get GRR is lambda A over B squared equals zero, and G theta is lambda R squared over B squared. There may be a misprint. I have to check this. Covariant conservation condition is purely algebraic. If you solve the Bianchi identities, you find that you don't have to solve a differential equation. It's just delta TT is minus 3 lambda over 8 pi GB. That gives you the fourth field equation. GTT is minus 3 lambda over B equals 0. And from that, you find that algebraically or numerically that the Ricci, the scalar curvature is 0 for this solution. So it's not like Einstein de Sitter, where lambda, where R is 4 lambda. Here R is 0, just like an ordinary Schwarzschild without a cosmological constant. Okay, some analytic and numerical results. What we find is this, if for 10 to the minus 17 centimeters times the mass, I'm having trouble, here we go, over the solar mass squared, within that distance of the nominal horizon, and for much less the cosmological distance, is the solution very closely approximates Schwarzschild. So the astrophysics of black holes is basically unchanged. Within this distance, things change. G naught naught never vanishes. If you go to a dimensionless variable x as lambda to the 1/2 r, then you, this is just one specific numerical example, b is a constant plus another constant times the square root. There's a cusp-like square root inside near the nominal horizon. The solution in polar coordinates becomes complex. But this is a coordinate singularity, r mu nu, r form 4 times r4 and so forth with four indices, they're all finite. There is a physical singularity at r equal infinity, which is likely a breakdown of the static assumption. We also looked at it in isotropic coordinates. Ds squared is b of r squared over a of r squared dt squared minus a of r to the fourth over r to the fourth times this. I put a square bracket here because these aren't the same solutions. These aren't the same functions as in Schwarzschild, where I use round brackets. Here, the field equations have very funny high powers. GRR is lambda a to the eighth over r to the fourth, b to the fourth. G theta is lambda a to the eighth over r squared, b to the fourth. And covariant conservation gives you GTT is 3 lambda a squared over b squared. And again, you get, you find there's a smooth solution. Now there's a physical singularity at small x and another singularity at large x. And if you integrate the proper distance between the two, you find it agrees with the proper distance that you infer from the polar coordinate solution, integrating from essentially r equals 0 to infinity. So you're not mapping the isotropic coordinates for the usual Schwarzschild have a twofold mapping. It maps twice from infinity down to the horizon and back. Here to five digits, it's mapping once. So we do believe that what we're seeing is the central singularity. And you're going through the horizon without any evidence of a singularity. There's no square root. We also have an inductive argument that the square root is removable in polar coordinates. Yeah?
I have a question. Maybe you said this already implicitly, and I didn't get it, but or explicitly, and I didn't get it. But do you have a principled way of choosing the time function, which tells you what G00 is?
No, I'm basically taking the time function as the one that's co-moving in Robertson-Walker, and that will come into the next part.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then for Schwarzschild, you just take the static?
I just take the static. Yeah, these are all static solutions, and that's probably why we find a physical solution, a physical singularity infinity. We try to look at the McVitie generalization, and we can never figure out whether the mathematical integrator sometimes is giving us a smooth join between small r and large r with no singularity, and sometimes it's going crazy. And we don't know whether the solution really is singular and there's no match, or whether the system is chaotic, and when you make small changes in parameters, sometimes you get a match and sometimes you don't, a true match. We never figured that out, and we say that in the paper.
And you don't have a closed form for this, these other components of the energy momentum tensor that make the energy conservation law hold.
Well, in the spherically symmetric case, it's just an algebraic. So you see there's no differential equation. You find that Bianchi just takes the form of an algebraic condition on T naught naught. In the other case I'll come to next, you get a first order differential equation to integrate. Okay, so I'm going to leave the Schwarzschild now. There's clearly something to do in Schwarzschild, which is what does it say about the information paradox? That's going to look very different in this solution, and we haven't begun to look at that. What I want to go to now is a question a lot of people ask me, both at the Galliano Island workshop and when in Princeton, what does this do to gravitational waves? Since gravitational waves have been detected, it better not mess things up. And so that led to the problem of looking at perturbations on the Robertson-Walker metric. So I now want to set up a phenomenology to distinguish between actions 1 and 2. And what I'll do is form a linear combination, 1 minus little f times the usual cosmological action plus little f times my effective action. So this is minus lambda over 8 pi g integral over the 4 volume, 1 minus f plus f g naught naught to the minus 2. So f is 0 for a standard cosmological constant, and f is 1 for a cosmological constant coming exclusively from the frame-dependent action. All right, so now let's address the problem of the conserving extension. So first, the perturbed Robertson-Walker metric. I'm only going to work the first order in perturbations. So g naught naught is 1 plus h naught naught, gi naught is equal to g naught I is hi naught, and gij is minus a squared of t delta ij plus hij. And if I vary with respect to gij, with respect to the spatial components, tij is lambda over 8 pi g. And now if I Taylor expand the 1 over g naught naught squared to first order and h naught naught, I get gij where this includes the first order perturbation, or the in the inverse, plus little f times tij. This is just algebra, where tij is 2 delta ij h naught naught over a squared of t. Now, the conserving extension of gij is just g mu nu. That's the statement that in the absence of perturbations, my frame-dependent action just mimics the usual cosmological constant. So what we need only to do is to find a conserving expansion of tij, but that's already first order. So that means that I can get away with using the zeroth order affine connections for the Robertson-Walker, which simplifies things a great deal. Yeah.
Yeah, this is probably a dumb question, Steve. What happened to the Einstein term?
The Einstein term?
Yeah, you're messing with the cosmological constant term.
The Einstein term is, I'm taking always as the same, it's always there.
It's unmodified.
It's unmodified, yes. And I don't address the question in any of this, two questions, why is lambda so small? And why is the Einstein term not conformally invariant? I just take this as a postulate that the cosmological constant represents some different physics. But I take the Einstein term as the usual one.
Okay, and you don't consider the case that G or lambda is time dependent, they're constants?
No, I just take G as constant.
And you modified lambdas.
I'm modifying the source of the lambda.
Okay.
And then looking for the consequences of that. Okay, so what I have to do is to solve d nu, little t mu nu, which is partial nu t mu nu plus gamma mu nu alpha t alpha nu plus gamma nu nu alpha t mu alpha equals 0. And since t is first order, I only need the unperturbed Robertson-Walker gamma. So I get two differential equations, one for t l 0, this is a 5 here, partial j t l j plus 5 a dot over a t naught l, and then partial naught, one for t naught naught in terms of t naught j. And these are both first order differential equations of a very familiar type, so you can integrate them immediately. And integrating, if I plug in what I know, which is tij is 2 delta ij a to the minus 2 of t h naught naught, I get TL naught is minus 2 a to the minus fifth of t, integral from a lower limit, and I'll explain that in a minute. I take it as t initial to t du a cubed of u partial L of h naught naught of u. And t naught naught is minus a to the minus 3 integral from t init to t du a cubed of u partial L t naught L of u plus 6 a dot over a h naught naught of u. And I've taken the lower limit. This could be an arbitrary constant of integrate, lower limit. It gives you a constant of integration. But if I want the solutions not to be singular where a is 0, I have to take t, the lower limit, to be the point where a is 0. Then I can use the zeroth order Robertson-Walker to get t sub mu nu from t super mu nu. And if I now split the Ricci tensor into a zeroth order part and a first order part, and the matter into a zeroth and first order part, this is all now standard stuff. The perturbed Einstein equation written in terms of the Ricci tensor is 0 is r mu nu 1 minus lambda h mu nu plus h pi g times t mu nu matter minus a half g mu nu t alpha alpha matter, the whole thing first order part, which means I have to take the zeroth here times the first plus the first here times the zeroth and so forth. And then the same thing for the addition, lambda f, my little t minus a half g mu nu 0 little t alpha alpha. And this is automatically first order already. So this is now, I've separated, I have the zeroth order equations of the standard cosmological equations, and this is the first order perturbation equation. All right, now let me discuss the issue of residual gauge invariance, because this will play an important role in seeing whether they're scalar waves or not. Let's make a coordinate transformation x alpha is x prime alpha minus epsilon alpha of x prime. To first order, it doesn't matter whether this argument is x prime or x. And epsilon naught is 0. So this is now not going to be a full four-space diffeomorphism, just a three-space diffeomorphism. Then to first order, this gives a gauge transformation. Delta gauge hij is a squared of t partial j epsilon I plus partial I epsilon g, j. Delta g hi naught is a squared of t partial naught of epsilon I. And h naught naught is invariant. And that implies that my little t mu nu, which was generated entirely by h naught naught, is also gauge invariant. Let me say, I decided when I started setting this up to use the coordinate time rather than the conformal time. And then I discovered that in Weinberg's big textbook on cosmology, that's what he did. And so all my equations, in fact, where there's an overlap, they all agree with what's in the standard textbook. Okay, now some algebra now. I'm not going to give this. It's in the paper. It shows that the gauge transformation of t first order matter is minus the pressure times delta g h mu nu. And that implies by, again, some more algebra doing the 0 times 1 plus the 1 times 0 here, that delta g of t mu nu matter minus a half g mu nu t alpha alpha matter is a half p minus rho delta g h mu nu. Now, by a long calculation, once you've calculated the Ricci tensor, you find that delta g r mu nu, delta g of r naught naught is 0, which matches delta g of h naught naught is 0. But delta g of r ij and r naught I had the same structure. They're a double dot over a plus 2 a dots over a squared times delta g of the corresponding perturbed h. So now when I look at the Einstein equation, delta g of r1 minus lambda h mu nu, just substituting this, I get a double dot over a plus 2 a dot over a squared minus lambda delta g h mu nu. Now I use the field equations to zeroth order, and I get h pi g a half rho minus p delta g h mu nu. But from the preceding transparency, that's just minus h pi g times delta g of the matter part. So that shows that the first order perturbed Einstein equation is fully gauge invariant. Okay, let me now introduce scalar, vector, and tensor decomposition. Since the whole thing is still rotationally invariant, you can follow the standard procedure of introducing scalar, vector, and tensor components of everything. And I follow the notation here of Weinberg's book. Okay, I'm not going to, all the details are again in appendices of the paper. What I've done here is in green, I've underlined the scalar pieces because they're going to be important for assessing whether they're scalar waves. So h naught naught is called E. Hi naught is minus a times partial if plus a vector. Hij is minus a squared A, which is a scalar, times delta ij, plus a double derivative of B, which is a scalar, plus a vector piece and a traceless and divergenceless tensor piece. D is divergenceless and traceless in this decomposition. Now we see if we take the gauge parameter epsilon I as a half partial IB, partial j of this brings down a second derivative, so delta g hij is just a squared partial I partial j of b, and that means we can eliminate the b term. This is a light Newtonian gauge, but not quite. It's the partial Newtonian gauge. In partial Newtonian gauge, you use the epsilon naught to eliminate one other scalar component, so you end up with just two scalar pieces. Here I end up still with three scalar potentials, but b is gone. So now I'll write down the modified scalar perturbation equations. From the ij components, you get 0 is delta ij, something called x, plus partial I partial jy. And I'm not going to read all the details. I'll just say what the things are. The first line of the matter perturbations using Weinberg's notation, it's exactly what's in the text. The second line are the metric terms, which agree with Weinberg when B is dropped. If you want to add the B, you just look at Weinberg, but I haven't checked it. I've just checked the pieces that I've computed. And then the third line is a new piece, the lambda FT mu new piece, which is a function entirely of H naught naught or E. So the X part has matter plus metric terms plus this additional piece that comes from the new cosmological action, the effect of the frame-dependent action. So you see that if F is 0, there's no cosmological constant in this. Weinberg in his book actually omits the cosmological constant, but in fact it cancels out of the first-order perturbation equations with a standard cosmological constant. But if you use the frame-dependent action for the cosmological constant, there isn't a change in the scalar perturbation equations. The Y equation has no change. And then from the I0, again, there's an extra piece, lambda F T naught I. And the 0, 0, there's an extra piece, lambda F times a half T naught naught plus 3 times E. And again, to stress, T naught naught and T naught I are entirely computable in terms of E, which is the H naught naught perturbation. So what's interesting about this is that it says that the scalar perturbation equations are modified when you go to the frame-dependent effect of action. And that could have implications for structure formation in the early universe. So what I want to do now is try and persuade people who are doing modeling of the CMB to put this into their calculations, because that will start confronting this with experiment, which I hadn't actually thought possible when I did the Schwarzschild thing with Fethi. We thought, well, you know, who cares what happens within 10 to the minus 17 centimeters of the horizon or in astrophysics? But this could have some observable consequences. Yeah?
Yeah, so isn't it more than just the equations are modified, but you have an extra degree of freedom?
Well, that's what I'm going to come to. You do, but I'll show you that there aren't scalar waves further. That's what I'm going to come to now. Yeah. Yeah, that's the question people raise. You don't have full gauge invariance. Why don't you mess up gravitational waves? And the reason is, if you for
you do have the same degree of gauge.
I have little less. I don't have the epsilon zero, but I have the epsilon I. So the three space diffeomorphism invariance gives me a large enough gauge group to eliminate the scalar waves. I'm going to give the argument for that now.
Steve, isn't the Weyl invariance a gauge invariance?
I'm not using local here. I'm just using a global Weyl invariance.
If you use it locally, you could eliminate it.
Possibly, yeah. But my argument, the action I wrote down, you're right, the action I wrote down is in fact local Weyl invariant if I omit the g-naught I terms. And that would be another argument for just omitting the g-naught I. In terms of the perturbation analysis, I didn't notice it when I wrote the paper. When I started putting the talk together, I noticed that the g-naught I terms in that thing I first wrote down, when you look at what they do to the Tij, they're second order in perturbations. But that's a good point, that if I invoke local conformal invariance, the square root of g over g naught naught squared is in fact local Weyl invariant. My argument from trace dynamics I was using, I needed global, because the T mu nu and for these all these different matter fields, I needed the global. But you're right, that if I use the local Weyl, that would also give me an additional invariance. I haven't used that. That would be interesting to look at.
But sorry, that confuses me a little bit, because the Einstein term is not.
The Einstein term is not, yeah. Okay, let me just stick with what I've said, because what I've said is invariant, that's right. The additional term is local invariant, but the Einstein term is not. So I'm just using the three-space diffeomorphism invariance. And that's enough to, as we'll see, to eliminate scalar waves. And I'll show you why. I went too far. Okay. Let's Fourier analyze. So what I'm going to do is to pull out the expansion factor A as a constant around some late time. Okay, so I'll say e to the I k dot ax. Partial I partial j then becomes ki kj, but that's independent from delta ij. So the ij equation then decouples into x equals 0 and y equals 0. In his book, Weinberg immediately goes to this decoupling, but if you write down, for example, x squared as the object, that's not true. But as soon as you Fourier analyze, things decouple. That means when matter perturbations are zero, you have four homogeneous equations and three unknowns, E, A, and F, because B is zero. So it's overdetermined, and in general, E and A and F have to then be zero. And that's why you eliminate the scalar waves. Now, if I had four space diffeomorphism invariants, I'd have four equations and two unknowns, so it's even more overdetermined, and you don't have scalar waves. But let me actually, this is sort of the heuristic argument. Let me give a concrete calculation now. What I do here is this is, as far as I can see, the maximal information I can include and still have equations with constant coefficients, which is what you need to get a simple analysis. So what I'll do is I'll Fourier analyze with e to the I k dot ax spatial, e to the minus I omega t time. I'll write a dot is equal to ha, and a double dot is h squared qa. But now I'm going to treat h, q, and a in the coefficients of the equations as constants. So I'm neglecting their Taylor expansions around the a at the time, some chosen time that's up in the spatial Fourier. Once you do that, you get equations with constant coefficients. Partial j becomes iakj, partial t becomes minus I omega, and integral dt becomes 1 over minus I omega. So you get a set of equations with constant coefficients. Two you can solve immediately to eliminate two variables, and then what you get is everything in terms of E. You get two more equations out of the four, and they take the form E is 0 is equal to E times k squared alpha plus beta, and 0 is equal to E k squared gamma times delta. Now, if alpha was equal to gamma and beta were equal to delta, these would be one equation, and you get a dispersion relation. But what happens is you find alpha is equal to gamma. It's I lambda FH over omega cubed over 1 plus IH over omega. Beta is Q minus 1 H squared plus 3 I lambda FH over omega. But delta is minus 3 beta. So therefore, the equations are overdetermined. They're inconsistent. And that means the only solution is E equals 0. So therefore, you don't get propagating scalar waves. OK, so let me summarize now. To zeroth order, Robertson-Walker is insensitive to F. It doesn't know whether the cosmological constant comes from the standard just integral over the invariant 4 volume or that over G naught naught squared. For Schwarz-like black holes, when I go to the frame-dependent action, there's no horizon where G naught naught is zero. The change is all within microscopic distances of the nominal horizon. In the papers, I left out the exponent 2. So I put in an erratum. But for a solar mass black hole, if the number I gave is correct, for a 10 to the 10th solar mass black hole, it becomes 3 centimeters and not what I said in the papers. It's still a small distance compared to the size of the hole. So the astrophysics is unchanged. Whoops. The question of the information paradox remains to be investigated. For Robertson-Walker perturbations, there's no change to gravitational wave theory. And the approximation that I use in the last view graph, if you apply that to the DIJ equation, you just get a telegrapher's equation. You get a wave equation damped on the Hubble scale. So that approximation gives a propagating wave, but applied to the scalars, as I showed, you don't get a propagating wave. And then there are possible detectable effects in early universe structure formation, which I hope I can convince people to start to explore. Thank you.
It's interesting, but so one thing that I think would be really interesting would be to see like the full direction. Dirac analysis of constraint analysis, because you have like some, like clearly you're breaking some version of so four-dimensional Diffie-Hellman
mm-hmm.
But GR has a lot of off-shell symmetries as well.
Mm-hmm.
It would be interesting to know exactly what the degrees of freedom are.
Well, I think the degrees of freedom is still the GIJ is basically the fundamental degree of freedom here. But it would be interesting to do a Dirac constraints analysis. Yeah.
It's also interesting how many independent components of the GIJ are there. Because if you're giving up one gauge symmetry, you'd think that you should get an extra degree of freedom somewhere. But sometimes weird things can happen. Like you can get
Well, no, you're right. The extra degree of freedom is the one. Normally, when you go to Newtonian gauge, you go from four scalars to two. I think it's the F, let's see. I think it's the F that's eliminated. I have to look at the paper. I don't eliminate that. So that's the extra degree of freedom. And there's ending up with three scalars rather than two scalars. So there is, you're right, there is an extra degree of freedom that in the usual analysis is eliminated by making a gauge transformation using an epsilon naught that depends on time, that's space-time dependent. But since it was sort of overkill to show that the equations were over-constrained in the four-space case, I still get just enough gauge invariance here to kill the scalar propagating modes. Yeah.
So your 10 to the minus 17 centimeters m over solar mass squared. And for supermassive black holes, that's the center of galaxies. That's even non-trivial. So the black hole center of MA7 is like six billion solar masses.
Right.
That's a couple centimeters.
Yeah, that's what I said. It's 3 centimeters. Yeah, I misstated in the paper because I was going to say curly M is a square, and then I didn't change it. Forgot to put the 2 in. But yeah, it's 3 centimeters.
And so for the Event Horizon Telescope, they're using 1 millimeter radio wavelength to look for shadow.
Yeah. Are they going to be able to reach the? Well, we'll see.
That's not clear to me.
Yeah. It's 3 centimeters for a 10 to the 10th solar mass black hole. But it's still a minute fraction of the size of the black hole, of the radius. We'll see. Yes?
Have you done the tensor and the vector modes for a gravitational wave field?
Well, the vector modes don't have right? The answer is there are no corrections to the vector or tensor equations because H naught naught is a scalar. Remember, I'm adding Tij, which is a function of E of the scalar, and it just adds to the scalar modes and not to the vector or tensor modes. So, let's see.
Yeah, because I was wondering if you can explain with it somehow why the tensor modes are so small with respect to the vector.
That's an interesting question, actually, that I have to think about. Whether my Tij... It depends on H naught naught, but can it depend... I'll have to look at that, whether that can actually add corrections to the tensor, to the traceless symmetric tensor part. I'm not sure. That's a good question now that you raise it. Yeah. Yeah.
Another suggestion is every time you have an extra degree of freedom in gravity, the best way to put the bounds on it is to go to binary pulsars.
Uh-huh.
Because we have exquisite measurements of the pulsars, and they're losing energy through the standard gravitation radiation that has two modes.
Yes.
So if gravity would have an extra channel for energy to be radiated, it would...
That's true. No, I think I have to go back and look at the vector and tensor equations and decompose the Tij into vector and tensor components as well as the scalar part and see what that does. I didn't do that, and that may be a big hole in what I said in the last part of the talk. I looked at the change in the scalar equations, but I'll have to go back and look at that. Yeah.
All right. So let's thank Stephen again.